We have one important announcement for this morning. Dr. Searcy Garrison, Executive Secretary of the Georgia Baptist Convention, will be on our campus on April 13th and 14th. He will speak in chapel on Tuesday morning, April 14th, and will be honored at a reception in the Bethay Room Tuesday afternoon from 3 until 4:30. All students from Georgia are invited and urged to attend. May we link our hearts in a moment of meditation and prayer. O righteous Father, thou who art the great creator and controller of this universe, we thank thee for the light of this day and for the life that stirs within us. We thank thee for the beauty of nature at this season, for books and art and music, and for all pure pleasures. We thank thee for the work which thou hast given us to do and for the strength with which to do it. We thank thee above all for the assurance of love and life in Jesus Christ. O thou who art the God of everlasting mercy, wilt thou grant us today hearts that are tender with compassionate concern for all of those to whom this day has brought less joy than it has brought to us. The unemployed, the overworked, the sick, those who are deprived of the pleasures of worshiping thee, and all of those who are anxiety-ridden, grief-stricken, and strife-torn. Dear Lord, wilt thou supply that measure of grace that is needed by all of those who look to thee through eyes of faith and of longing. Thou God of infinite wisdom and inexhaustible grace, have mercy upon our world in this difficult and dangerous day. Give guidance to those in positions of authority and responsibility, and grant that thy kingdom may come and thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. For we ask it in the name and for the sake of Jesus. Amen. May we continue our worship by joining in the singing of hymn number 382. It is my pleasure today to present as our speaker for this service, Professor J. Roy Porter. Professor Porter occupies at the present the chair of theology at the University of Exeter in Exeter, England. I understand that this chair was created specially for him, and this means, in effect, that he is head of the Department of Theology in the University of Exeter. Professor Porter is currently serving on the Hebrew Translation Panel for the New English Bible, Old Testament, and on the Greek Translation Panel for the New English Bible, Apocrypha. He has written extensively for the Journal of Theological Studies, the periodical devoted to biblical study, published by the Clarendon Press in Oxford. His most recent publications are Moses and Monarchy, a study in the biblical tradition about Moses, and an essay in the recent S.H. Hook festschrift, Promise and Fulfillment. An extensive commentary on the Book of Judges by Professor Porter is now in the hands of the Oxford University Press, and he is currently at work on a book on Israelite kingship, which will include, I believe, some of the material that he is presenting here in our chapel. Professor Porter has lectured widely in England, in Germany, and in other European countries. It is a high privilege and honor for us to have him visit on our campus, and it is with pleasure and profit that we will hear his lecture this morning. Professor Porter.
I propose to speak this morning about the theory that before the establishment of the monarchy, the Israelite tribes were organized in a confederation to which, in modern scholarship, the term amphictyony is commonly applied. Indeed, you can hardly open any book about the Old Testament without coming across that word pretty quickly. And yet, I think it's worthwhile spending a little time considering it this morning, because discussions of the meaning of this term as applied to Israel are very rare, very uncommon, at any rate in English. If you look at the standard Bible dictionaries, such as, for example, the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, you will not find any article specifically on this subject. And perhaps I may begin by defining rather carefully what I think is meant by this term amphictyony, because, as we shall see, I think, in a moment, such a definition is not without its importance. The word amphictyony is, of course, a Greek one, and it means, literally, a community that dwells around. Dwells around what? A community that dwells around a central temple or shrine. And it is a community which exists primarily for the upkeep and maintenance of that temple or shrine. Thus, in Greece and Italy, in the classical period, we find leagues, which are called amphictyonies, consisting of 12 or sometimes of 6 tribes. This number 12 or 6 being determined by the fact that each tribe was responsible for the upkeep of the central sanctuary for 1 month or 2 months each year. Now, it is this meaning of the term amphictyony which has been applied to the Israelite Confederation. And thus, when the term amphictyony is used, properly speaking, it should mean 2 things in particular. First, that the league, the confederation in question, consisted of 12 tribes, the historic 12 tribes of Israel. And secondly, that along with these 12 tribes, there existed also a central sanctuary. Not, of course, necessarily the sole sanctuary, as was later on the case in Israel with Jerusalem, but one central sanctuary for the whole confederation, and that each tribe was responsible for the upkeep of that central shrine for 1 month throughout the year. Why I have spent a little time in elucidating this point is because the term amphictyony, very often in modern writing about the Old Testament, tends to get used rather loosely to mean just any old confederation of tribes, whatever the number of the tribes or whatever their characteristics. And perhaps I may illustrate this by a little parable from a recent work of Old Testament scholarship. It has recently appeared in this country a book called Studies and Essays in Honor of Abraham A. Neumann, which was reviewed in an English periodical by Professor H.H. Rowley, whom I believe has lectured here, and of course is one of the most distinguished Old Testament scholars in the world. And in this collection of essays, there is an essay by Professor H.M. Orlinsky called The Tribal System of Israel and Related Groups in the Period of the Judges. In his in his review, Professor Rowley mentions this essay and says, in recent years, it has come to be widely accepted that the Israelite tribes in that period constituted an amphictyony or confederacy of tribes with a central sanctuary. The reviewer has never been convinced of this. Now, on the fifth page of his article, Professor Orlinsky says, numerous scholars have assumed or argued for amphictyonies of varying numbers of tribes in different periods at different centers. And the first reference he gives for this statement is to page 125 of Professor Rowley's book, From Joseph to Joshua, where indeed we read the following, that Hebron was an amphictyonic sanctuary for the confederacy of 12 tribes that entered from the south is probable enough. And again, it seems probable that Kadesh was an older amphictyonic center for this group. Now, the point is that these facts do not point to a change of mind on Professor Rowley's part, nor even to a lapse of memory, but to something far more important, namely to a rather distressing vagueness and ambiguity in the use of the term amphictyony. When Professor Rowley says that he doesn't believe in an Israelite amphictyony, he means the view that the 12 tribes and their central sanctuary existed as an organized religio-political system in the period before the introduction of the monarchy. When, on the other hand, he says that amphictyonic organizations centered on Hebron or Kadesh are probable, he means simply that there may well have been a number of alliances between various elements, both Israelite and non-Israelite, at different times and places during the period of the Hebrew settlement in Palestine, and that these alliances bore a general resemblance to the amphictyonies which we know from Greece and Italy. There's a good deal of difference between these two uses of the word, and I would suggest that it is necessary to reject the temptation to employ the term amphictyony to denote virtually any kind of organized group of Israelite or other tribes. And instead, I think we should concentrate our attention on the picture of the Israelite amphictyony given by Professor Martin Note, in a monograph published in 1930, which has been the foundation for all later study of the subject. Though I must say that from what many scholars say about it, I think it's one of those books that's more referred to than read. I want to deal with some of Note's evidence in some detail in due course. But first of all, I should like to call attention to what seems to me perhaps the most significant aspect of his exposition. For Note, the amphictyony is a system which embraces the entire nation. Even, it may be said, it constitutes whatever is to be understood by Israel. And this is true also for those of Note's followers who would not accept his view that Israel only came into being on the soil of Palestine. The amphictyony, as such, was constituted by a covenant between the participating tribes and the national god. As I expect many of you are aware, Martin Note, of course, does not identify this covenant in the period of the Judges with the covenant at Sinai. Indeed, he's altogether somewhat vague about it. But many of those who have accepted his postulate of an Israelite amphictyony have viewed it as a reaffirmation and extension of the Mosaic covenant. So that, somewhat ironically, what was a keystone in Note's distinctly negative reconstruction, or lack of reconstruction, of Israel's early history, has come to be a bulwark of a much more positive attitude to the Pentateuchal narratives than he could ever allow. This is one very important reason for a careful study of the evidence which is alleged to prove the existence of an amphictyony, in the sense in which we're considering the term. For if, to quote John Bright's History of Israel, the origins of the amphictyonic system reach back to Sinai, it is at least equally true to say that the existence of the amphictyonic system is used by him and many other scholars as strong evidence for the reality of what occurred at Sinai. But if the amphictyony is thus highly significant for its backward reference in the religion and life of Israel, it is nonetheless so in its forward reference. Characteristic of much recent work on the Old Testament has been the attempt to fill out the details of the amphictyonic system and to show how it rests on a rich and distinctive complex of ideas, at least in the religious sphere. One might instance the investigation into the nature of the covenant by such scholars as Mendenhall in this country and Barlin in Germany, and theories of some scholars which give the covenant a specific cultic setting in life in which it was regularly renewed and its terms represented to succeeding generations. The religion of the amphictyony, thus reconstructed, represents, it is asserted, true Yahwism. We can again give positive content to that deposit which older scholars sought to isolate out from the Old Testament as the product of the work of Moses, but which had become more and more tenuous as, on the one hand, literary criticism increasingly showed how difficult it was to extract any firm historical facts from the Pentateuch, and on the other, the so-called myth ritual school increasingly assimilated the religion of Israel to her contemporary background. So it is held, even when the amphictyony's body was dead, its soul went marching on. After the outward amphictyonic organization had been superseded by the monarchy, which was quite different from it and in many respects opposed to it, its faith and ideals continued to be cherished and kept alive at various shrines and among various groups. Hence, a good deal of attention is paid in modern scholarship to what is called the amphictyonic tradition, and evidences of its influence are found in many different parts of the Old Testament. A very influential example, which may be familiar to some of you, is von Rath's view of the Book of Deuteronomy as reflecting amphictyonic ideals, ideals which had been kept alive among the country Levites and the country gentry, with the old amphictyonic shrine of Shechem in the background. Again, Professor Meilenberg has recently argued in an important article that the E material of the North is the last link in a traditio historical chain that runs through Shechem again back to another amphictyonic center at Gilgal. Now, these are only a few out of a welter of such studies of the alleged amphictyonic tradition. And I'm bound to say that when I read many of them, I feel rather like Alice in Wonderland confronted with the Cheshire Cat's grin, which you will remember remained some time after the rest of it had gone. There's a good deal of discussion about the tradition, but often only the vaguest awareness that something is needed to produce the tradition. But even in Wonderland, the cat came before the grin. If there was no amphictyony, there will be no amphictyonic tradition. And the second very important reason for looking carefully at the evidence for a truly historical amphictyony is to discover how far the view I have sketched of the nature of Hebrew religion before the exile has any real basis in fact. Now, let us then turn to consider the evidence. As I suggested, the two most important features of the Israelite amphictyony are first that it consisted of 12 tribes, and secondly that it centered on a particular sanctuary. Now, to take the first point, the number of the 12 tribes, note in the work I have referred to, emphasizes very strongly that the 12-tribe system is a self-contained one. The tradition of the 12 children of Israel, he writes, has not arisen from a combination of 12 unconnected elements. That is, it has not just growed. It has not resulted from the mere fact of there happening to be 12 tribes who eventually joined together. The system is artificial, using that word in a quite neutral sense. It was organized, it was planned for a definite purpose. The basis of this view is the existence of a number of lists of the 12 tribes, all of which lists, however, note holds, can be divided between two forms, which are basically the same, but differ as to the inclusion or exclusion of the tribe of Levi. If all this is so, it is plainly of vital importance to try and decide the date of these lists, as this is the likeliest way of arriving at some estimate of the date of the establishment of the 12-tribe system. Now, it is perhaps worth making the point at the outset that in the Old Testament as it stands, none of these lists is associated with the period of the Judges. Some are placed in the patriarchal period, such as Genesis chapter 30 and Genesis chapter 49. Other lists are associated with Moses, such as those in Numbers and in Deuteronomy chapter 27 and chapter 33. Others, again, are linked with the time of David, such as those in 1 Chronicles 12 and 1 Chronicles 27. While, finally, we may just mention the list in the account of the future temple in Ezekiel chapter 48. The only exception which might be brought forward is the description of the division of Palestine among the 12 tribes after the conquest of the country in Joshua chapter 13 through 19. But at this point, it is necessary to pass from a mere review of the surface picture of the Old Testament to consider how far it is possible to fix the real date of the lists with which we are concerned. Now, Joshua chapters 13 through 19 have been very exhaustively studied, and I propose to accept here the views of Alt and Note, who've studied them most thoroughly, as being most likely to lend support to the theory of a pre-monarchical amphictyony. It is true that in these chapters, 12 tribes are allotted particular areas. But it has been shown that the material is not homogeneous and that it falls into two organically quite separate sections. There is a document which sets out the tribal boundaries in the pre-monarchic age, and also a list of cities, which outdates in the time of King Josiah, though somewhat earlier dates in the monarchical period have been suggested by other authorities. Now, what's important to notice, however, is that the figure of 12 tribes in these chapters has only been produced by the combination of these two sources. For the boundary list does not mention the tribes of Dan, Issachar, Manasseh east of the Jordan, or Simeon. Thus, even if the boundary list does date from the period of the Judges, it provides no evidence for the existence of a 12-tribe system at this period. Of course, one can suggest all sorts of hypotheses to explain the omissions, but these would only be necessary if the fact of the 12-tribe system could be established on other grounds. As witnesses for the self-contained tradition of a division of Israel into 12 tribes, only three passages, says Note, need to be discussed. All the other lists ultimately depend on the tradition enshrined in these passages, which are Genesis chapter 49, Numbers chapter 26, and Numbers 1, verses 5 to 15. With regard to the first of these, Genesis 49, Note himself says that in its existing form, it originates from the time of David or Solomon. In the view of many scholars, with reference to the crucial verse in that chapter, verse 10, about Shiloh, it could well be considerably later in the monarchical period than that. Note describes this chapter, Genesis 49, surely correctly, as a product of the collecting together of originally individual and independent proverbial sayings about the Israelite tribes. No doubt this may well mean that particular individual sayings in this chapter are older than the document as a whole. The important point, however, is that the oracle about Judah, which is necessary to make up the number of 12 tribes, reflects the situation when Judah had achieved preeminence as a result of the establishment of the Davidic kingdom. This strongly suggests that Judah was not reckoned among the tribal confederacy until after the inauguration of the monarchy. And we shall see later that there are other grounds for holding this view. And if this is so, it would imply that the 12-tribe system is post-Davidic, since, of course, Judah is an essential component of that system. The problem is more difficult with regard to Numbers chapter 26. For Note claims that these verses can be assigned, I quote, with complete certainty, to the second half of the so-called period of the Judges. It must be said at once that Note only attains this complete certainty by means of pretty drastic surgery. In particular, he cuts out the figures in this chapter, since he realizes that a population of some 3 to 4 million, which they imply, would be absurd for any sort of Israelite federation during the period of the settlement. Note justifies this treatment of the material by claiming that as it stands, the chapter reveals two distinct concerns. The division of the tribes into their respective clans, on the one hand, and the enumeration of the tribes' available warriors, on the other. And that only the former was the purpose of the original list. But this is a pure assumption. And it's least reasonable to hold that the supposed two concerns, in fact, belong very closely together. The list gives the total fighting force of the tribes and also the subdivisions from which the troops could be levied when occasion arose. An attempt has been made to defend the figures in Numbers chapter 26 from the charge of being mere fantasy, and so to permit the view that we have here a genuinely old document by Mendenhall in an article in the Journal of Biblical Literature for 1958. He argues that in this chapter, the Hebrew word, which is translated by the English word thousand, does not mean literally a thousand, but denotes simply a subsection of the tribe. So that when we read the Simeonites, for example, numbered 22,200 men, this originally meant that the tribe was divided into 22 groups, which together could muster a force of 200 men. It seems indeed that this Hebrew word we're discussing does sometimes mean just a subdivision of a tribe, but our evidence suggests that it was the only such subdivision before the immediate family group was reached. And as such, this word has exactly the same sense as the word usually translated by family. Now, in Numbers 26, the tribes are listed according to their families. And Mendenhall's theory would require the word that is translated by thousand to mean a further subdivision between the family and the household. And for this meaning of the word, there is, as far as I can see, no evidence at all. And it's difficult to resist the conclusion that when we read, for example, at Numbers 26:37, These are the families of the sons of Ephraim, according to their number, 32,500, that the writer meant us to take the figure as representing the total male population of the families or clans of the tribe in question. It is even harder to follow Note's further contention that the list in Numbers 26 must be pre-monarchical, because some of the clan names there occur as place names on inscriptions from Samaria. When Note wrote, these inscriptions were dated in the time of Ahab, but they're now considered to be over a century later in the reign of King Jeroboam II. In any case, all that these inscriptions can tell us is that the names in question were current at the period when they were written down. They may well have been in use much earlier, no doubt they were, but they may equally well have been in use much later, since place names are extremely tenacious. And if it be said that the clan names of Numbers 26 have become the place names of the Samaria inscriptions, and no one, and surely least of all Note, can deny that the reverse process is at least equally likely. Little need be said about the third key list, that of Numbers 1. Note himself holds that it is in any case later than Numbers 26, and Mendenhall's argument for its being early largely depends on his interpretation of this word translated thousand, which we've already dealt with. The main interest of Numbers 1 for the subject under discussion lies in the list there of the tribal leaders, which I'll say more in a moment. It is not, I suggest, unfair to conclude, then, that the lists of the 12 tribes provide no clear evidence for the existence of a 12-tribe confederacy in the period of the Judges, and indeed a certain amount of evidence against it. Now, I want to pass on at this point to consider the second important feature of the Amphictyony, namely the question of the existence of the central sanctuary in the pre-monarchical period. Here at the outset, we find an important difference between what we know to have been the case for the Amphictyonies of Greece and Italy and what has been proposed with regard to the Israelite Amphictyony. For the former, the situation in Greece and Italy, the sanctuary was the whole purpose, the whole reason for the existence of the League. The League came into being for the upkeep of a particular shrine. For Israel, the League would have created the central sanctuary, since, in Bright's words, it needed this as a focal point, whatever that means. Hence, many scholars have found no difficulty in assuming that this sanctuary moved about a good deal in ancient Israel. Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, and most recently Gibeon have all been suggested as the site of the central sanctuary at varying epochs. But is not this peripatetic character of the central sanctuary so unlike what characterizes Amphictyonies elsewhere, a rather curious thing? And is there not a good deal of truth in Professor Orlinsky's contention that many scholars appear to assume the existence of an Amphictyonic League almost wherever and whenever a biblical book records the existence of a shrine? Where so many different places are alleged to display Amphictyonic features, may it not be that these features are not primarily Amphictyonic, but simply features that were common to all important sanctuaries? It's hardly possible this morning to review the whole list of the candidates, but two of the more likely of them may be selected for a slightly more detailed examination. Professor Bright is dubious as to the existence of any central sanctuary other than Shiloh, which became such, he claims, after the conquest. To begin with, the evidence from the early chapters of the first book of Samuel, which alone, I think, might suggest that Shiloh was an amphictyonic center, come from shortly before the inauguration of the monarchy. And since Bright holds that the period of the judges lasted some 200 years, we may well wonder what had been happening previously. It is true that Joshua, chapter 18, verse 1, records the setting up of the tent of meeting at Shiloh by the whole congregation. But since this is accompanied by the statement that the whole land lay subdued before them, its historical accuracy is somewhat suspect. Nor does Shiloh, in the period of the judges, appear to show much evidence of the amphictyonic tradition, as that has been described earlier, with its supposed mosaic and nomadic aspects. Instead, in the early chapters of the first book of Samuel, we find at Shiloh a regular temple, where the chief annual celebration was a vintage festival with strong fertility aspects, the practice of ritual incubation, and more than a hint of ritual prostitution. And much is made of the fact that the ark was kept at Shiloh, but ever since W.R. Arnold's very interesting and important book, Ephod and Ark, it has become increasingly likely that an ark was part of the furniture of many shrines, and that we should be cautious when we read of any particular one, any particular ark, of automatically assuming that it was the national or amphictyonic symbol. The Shiloh Ark may rather owe its importance to the historicized myth of its heroic exploits among the Philistines in 1 Samuel chapters 4 to 6, and above all, to the fact that it was traditionally identified with the Ark from the neighboring Judean shrine of Kiriath Jearim, which David transferred to Jerusalem. The assumption that this ark was the ancient amphictyonic symbol has led to the almost universal opinion that David's moving of it to Jerusalem was a brilliant and far-sighted stroke of policy, designed to unite all the Israelite tribes under the aegis of his new monarchy and his new neutral capital of Jerusalem. If such was David's intention, the famous court history of his reign, a document of very great historical value, shows that he signally failed. But one may wonder how far he had any such conscious idea at all, or how far his view of the Ark was the same as that of so many modern critics. Nor can very much be built on the character of the priesthood at Shiloh. Perhaps the family there claimed to have been priests in Egypt, and perhaps even to be descended from Aaron, though this is not explicitly stated. And just what sort of a figure and how prominent Aaron would have appeared in the judges' period is a nice question. However, even if this is so, it is not enough to allow us to say, to allow us to postulate a distinctive national priesthood at Shiloh. For according to the book of Judges, there was an Aaronic priesthood also at Bethel, and a Mosaic one at Dan. And it's interesting to observe that the members of the latter are described simply as priests to the tribe of the Danites. Once again, Shiloh may well have been the center of a confederation, but was it one that extended beyond the contiguous tribes of Ephraim and Benjamin, plus an old Canaanite city? There is perhaps even less to be said in favor of Shechem in this connection. It is difficult to get round the fact that the historical truth about the city in the pre-monarchical period is contained in the 9th chapter of the book of Judges, where it appears as a Canaanite enclave with its own deity and its own temple, though enjoying an alliance with the tribe of Manasseh. No doubt the episode in Joshua chapter 24 is important, but exactly what it signifies and what is the date of the episode are questions that it is not easy to answer. The 12 tribes in that chapter are not specifically mentioned as making up the assembly, while the putting away of foreign gods is an old Shechemite rite, as Genesis chapter 35 shows. as is also covenant making, as witness Genesis chapter 38 and the epithet of the God of Shechem, the God or the Lord of the covenant. Again, the chapter would fit in very nicely with an amphictyonic organization had we evidence that such a thing existed on other grounds. But it does not of itself provide the proof we need. Further investigation of other alleged amphictyonic sanctuaries would, I suggest, produce much the same result. And by way of summary, it may be stated that in the period of the Judges, all these appear as essentially local and tribal sanctuaries. Smaller or larger Israelite groups no doubt assembled at them on particular occasions and for particular purposes. But it is impossible to show that any of them was a regular center for a clearly organized 12-tribe league over any considerable period. Now, I'm very much aware that this lecture has been very largely negative and critical. It's only fair, no doubt, to the scholars I've criticized, that I should, at the end, very briefly stick my own neck out and tell you what I think about this question. But I shall be very brief about this. The likeliest dates, it seems to me, for the 12 tribe lists in Genesis and Numbers suggests that Mowinckel is right in holding that the 12 tribe system, not of course any individual tribe composing it, is after the time of David. The 12 governmental divisions of Solomon's kingdom are not the same as this 12 tribe system, but neither are they wholly unrelated to it. The studies of Alt and Albright have shown that these divisions roughly correspond to the traditional areas of tribal settlement, and some tribal names actually occur among them. Perhaps the 12 tribe list, or rather lists in the plural, for there are more varieties than has sometimes been allowed for, perhaps the 12 tribe list represents another arrangement based on the number 12, which was prominent in the organization of states in the ancient Near East. Some of the 12 tribe lists, such as those in Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33, seem to have as their purpose the collection and preservation of old tribal material. Others, such as that of Numbers 26, seem to reflect a census, probably for military purposes, or an attempt to settle the areas of clan and tribes. Either of these two concerns would find a better setting in life in an organized state, when the Israelites were for the first time in real possession of the whole land of Palestine, rather than in the fluctuating conditions of the occupation period represented as it is by the book of Judges. There is no need to set up an amphictyonic tradition in opposition to a monarchical one, if by the former you mean traditions about the patriarchs, Moses, the Exodus, the Sinai covenant, and the tribes. For there are plenty of examples, for instance, Psalm 78, of their being fully and happily united. No doubt you can make it difficult to unite monarchical and allegedly amphictyonic traditions if you postulate a clear, well-organized amphictyony which also first organized these traditions of itself. But in the last resort, it is the fact of the existence of the 12 tribe lists that has to be explained. It's the lists that need some sort of explanation. And the amphictyony is only a hypothesis to do this, and perhaps not the only conceivable one.
O God, thou who hast been the refuge of our fathers throughout all generations, we pray that thou wilt be for us today a refuge in every time and circumstance of need. Wilt thou be our guide through all that is dark and difficult and doubtful, and our guardian against all that threatens our spiritual well-being, and wilt thou gladden our hearts with thy joy and thy peace. For we ask it in Jesus' name.